That's right. Welcome back to another series, I should say, of political football. Some said we might get cancelled after season one. To those, I say, we're still here. It's the year of the pulley. It's the year of the ox. We're ready to go. Big season coming. Joey Boyden, mate, it's great to have you back. One of my day ones. How are we going here, mate? What's cracking?
I knew we'd make it through the pilot season, mate. We're back, season two. Took longer than I thought. I was a bit delayed. But nevertheless, we're here and we're ready to go, and I'm pumped.
So some of you might be wondering what we're going to call this episode, because you know we've had some great references and great titles in the past, but this one's taking my intertextuality game to a new level. It's called I Love You, Jenny, not only in reference to one of my favourite movies of all time, Forrest Gump, and his favourite line, I love you, Jenny, but more so in relation to Scott Morrison seeking guidance and moral empathy from his wife, Jenny Morrison. And also in relation to our little sport teaser there, Naomi Osaka, after winning the Australian Open, asking Jennifer Brady, the person she beat, whether she prefers to be called Jennifer or Jenny. She said Jenny, and she goes, thanks so much for playing today, Jennifer. What a little psych on the court. But that's neither here nor there. Let's get into it. Let's don't waste any more time for the humble abode here in Cinque Docker. Very topical podcast here today. We'll be talking about the Brittany Higgins scenario in relation to the workplace culture inside Parliament House, but less so about who knew what when or a sequential of, you know, playing out of events. As always here at Political Football, we are solution driven. We want to get to the crux of the issue and dominate from there. And what do we got in sport this week, Boyzo?
Sport, let's wrap up the cricket season. Also, Indigenous All-Stars, Maori All-Stars wrap up just from last weekend. And we'll go through the tennis as it just ended a few days ago. And we'll get into a couple of fan questions that our inbox has been piling up over the summer. We just can't contain it, so we got to get some of them out to you guys and answer the long-awaited questions that you guys have been pumping us with.
We're very much looking forward to that. But as always, we'd like to cover off the policy issue first and get a conversation to go against amongst that 18 to 30 demographic that we so wonderfully capture. But starting off here, as we promised, with the scenario of Miss Higgins' alleged rape by a colleague in former employee MP Linda Reynolds' office on the 23rd of March 2019. As I said, now we can sit all here all day, talk about the chronology events and who knew what when. That seems to be dominating the media landscape at the moment because they love to get into the political crux of the issue. But ever since Samantha Maiden broke the news for news.com.au last Monday, there's been a variety of commentary around that. So we're going to steer clear of that. More so, we're going to focus on the nature of the reviews that's been announced by the Prime Minister and various members of Parliament. As well as get towards the crux of the issue, look at the power imbalance that perhaps exacerbates this problem in what they consider an unorthodox workplace, that is Parliament House, and look at perhaps some of the solutions around education, how we can break down the cultural embeddedness that seems to take place where there is a, you know, where there's one sort of position of dominance from and a power imbalance, as we should say. So it all comes back to that power imbalance. But let's start off here. Joe, perhaps you could just give us your initial thoughts on the incident. Where do you think the problem lies here?
Honestly, I think the problem lies mostly in the fact that there's this like stigma that you can either speak out, but that'll come at the cost of your job or sacrificing what you've worked hard for. So the problem is in the pressure that's on people that if they speak out, there's going to be a negative backlash towards them rather than them being able to speak out and defend themselves and maintain what they've worked hard for. So I guess there's this fear of protecting your personal identity at the cost of your professional career, whereas it should be protecting your professional career and your personal identity together. I think the problem is that the two are separated and that needs to stop, I guess. If something unprofessional happens in the workplace, the personal and the professional can't be separated. They're two things that intertwine. So I definitely think the problem is in the backlash that people have an idea that if you speak out, negative things are going to happen to your career.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head like you do most times here, mate. And again, yeah, And she did express, Ms. Higgins did express some level of that feeling that you said in relation to, she felt like she'd become a political problem because of an incident which she had no fault of her own. Just because she's had a few drinks doesn't mean, you know the old adage, you know, she's asking for it, or that's some sort of old school mentality that seems to still exist at some level. And here she was having to make a decision in her perspective from her mentorship and someone she was supposed to be trusted and someone who's an employer is supposed to look after her, felt like she was had to choose between the future of her dream job, that's what she said, it was her dream job to be in this capacity, against seeking justice for a rape, which is one of the most heinous crimes that can be committed against another human. So I think you hit the nail on the head there as well. And it goes, I suppose, if we go into the crux of the problem here, it does go to the power imbalance that there's only 7 female coalition MPs in the current ministry of 30, and only 5 of 22 hold senior cabinet positions inside the ministry. So you have these, for search of a better term, these old white codgers holding the balance of power and decision making, which skews policy formation, which means it becomes gender blind. So especially when it comes to processes around sexual assault or rape or any issue that is female dominated, we've seen the pandemic on a larger scale has largely affected women, but there's been a lack of policies that are actively targeted towards women in terms of curtailing that. You know, we see childcare, you know, not being addressed, you know, aged care, these industries which are, have a high proportion of female engagement and high proportion of females to males. So what I'm trying to get to there is that there's a macro level there that especially issues that disproportionately affect women, there seems to be an insufficient level of policy engagement with the women, you know, who are in the room making these decisions. It's one thing to be in cabinet, but then you got the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Treasurer, the Home Affairs Minister, these supercharged portfolios, they're all hosted by, you know, in there by hosted by males. And I do think that is an issue. And again, I don't want to make this a whole referendum on the coalition. I know some of our coalition voters who listen to the podcast will be upset if I did that. So again, I'm trying to take the high road here. I'm sure there's been issues in the Labor Party and other political parties in relation to sexual assault and cover-ups in relation to crimes and allegations. Emma Husa comes to mind in relation to the false claim of bullying against her, which effectively drove her out of Canberra. But it is worth noting that the Labor Party has a better ratio of female MPs, making up 47% of its caucus. So I do think that goes a long way to actually getting a strong female voice in the parliament. And there's a variety of, you know, strong ministers inside there. So I think that until you get better female representative in the coalition, you're still going to have these gender-blind policies in which, you know, crimes like this is sort of as spellbinding it is to me that this could take place in the citadel of an Australian democracy outside of work hours, inside a minister's office. And here we are talking about who knew what when, and not trying to actually solve the issue of how we could actually go ahead and sort of assist Ms. Higgins in a pursuit for justice and how this possibly took place.
The thing is, when something like this happens in a professional setting, it automatically in everyone's heads becomes so much more complex. Like, we're talking about a colleague who's been... No, someone who's been sexually assaulted or raped by their own colleague, right? But if that wasn't one of her colleagues, that the guy who did it gets prosecuted just, and it's just your standard other rape case. I mean, not standard because you can't, you know, that's not a standard crime.
Yeah.
But when it becomes colleagues, it makes things so much more complex, but we always lose sight on the fact that, like, no matter if they're colleagues or they work in different industries or they're from different countries, whatever, the acts still happen. There was still sexual assault. And the simplicity of it is that is a horrific crime. So we can make it as complex in our heads as we want with statistics and blah, blah, blah. But, like, let's treat the real cause of the issue here. Like, yeah, let's not lose sight on that. I know preventing it in the future is the most important fact, but if this has happened, that needs to be dealt with now.
Yep.
Rather than pushing that aside just to think about future implications. I think the actual immediacy of it is dealing with the thing that has happened already. So yeah, let's get to that next for sure. But that he has to be like, this has to be sorted right now for sure.
And just one final point I'd like to make on that. Now there is a series of reviews in motion, three of them internal, one that's external, but that will take several months to get off the ground. Again, I feel like these reviews are almost standard process these days. Is there anything actually come of them? We've seen Royal Commission after Royal Commission go through, and a lot of the recommendations actually not to pass through Parliament. But on the power imbalance, and as we were saying before, the core issue of Brittany Higgins feeling like she was having to choose between her job and seeking justice, is that, you know, people will say to me, why would she feel like that's that position? And again, I'm going to come from an outside perspective looking in, but I think it's a valid perspective. Now, I'm not making any comparisons between Rochelle Miller and Alan Tudge's conceptual affair that, you know, they had a couple of years ago in Parliament, or Christian Porter's nefarious activities in Public Bar in Canberra. But what I'm making a conclusion is that the implications are the same. Every single time the female has felt the wrath of the consequences, they've been moved from office to office and eventually moved out of a job. Rochelle Miller, long-time press secretary and media officer there, she's out of a job. And Alan Tudge, Christian Porter, and this guy who's, as far as I'm concerned, in another job in Sydney, who hasn't faced any consequences for the alleged rape that he perpetrated, the burden falls on the woman and the male gets away scot-free. And that pun was fully intended. So until we change that cultural expectation and get some cultural harmony inside Parliament House, any other workplace where the burden doesn't always fall on the woman, then the issue isn't going
to
be solved.
For sure. And I think to fix the issue, it can't just be encouragement to the women to speak out alone. Like that's one thing you see. You see a lot of other women calling other people to come out and talk. And yes, that encourages it, but they have to be protected as well. Yeah. Like the women have to be protected if they want to talk, because you can't blame them for being scared about wanting to talk. It's the same thing. Whenever you are under a position where someone has authority over you, you're like, you don't want to ruffle feathers. Yeah. Like if you're in a job, like, and that's what you've been working, you don't want to ruffle feathers at all. Like you can't blame them for not wanting to speak out. It's just like, but it's just now we're at the U-turn point where it can't get any worse now. Yeah. It has to start getting better and protection has to happen.
Well, I think that's a fantastic way to finish that, Joe. Again, I just had to qualify that. We're a couple of males in our early 20s talking about it. So again, we're not going to provide perhaps the insight that one of our female counterparts could. But I do think it's important that as young men, we do engage in these conversations, because it's important that we don't sideshow, put these on the, you know, on the side burner and let these things fester. But moving on to another issue that's quite close to my heart, to Paulie A. Smith's heart, it's something that flew under the radar in light of all the Facebook controversy last week and the allegations around Brittany Higgins' rape. As the landline goes in the background, that's rather convenient. I'm just going to ignore that and keep on talking.
It's a fan. Bloody,
unbelievably.
It's Stephen A. Smith.
Stephen A. Smith would love to, he might make an appearance later in the podcast.
Sport's not on yet.
But issue two was the merger of the Family Court of Australia with the Federal Circuit Court of Australia. Now, for those of you who have never been involved in the Family Court of Australia or don't understand what it actually does, perhaps that would seem like a sentence off the top of your head that doesn't actually mean much. But it does mean a lot in implications of what it means around family law. So things around marriage, divorce, separation, allocation of property, and of course, most importantly, allocation of custody of children. So these are very emotionally charged responsibilities in court. And in 1975, under the Lionel Murphy and Lionel Bowen and what they fought for under the Whitlam government, they effectively eradicated no-fault divorce. And from the words I hear from my grandmother and from what my mum tells me about my great-grandmother, it was a significant moment in improving women's rights in terms of the family dynamic. So it's had a long-standing history, But now the family court is no longer. It's now called the federal. It's part of the Federal Circuit Court of Australia, and there's been staunch opposition to say the least in relation to this. Again, as I've said many times, including today on IGTV, one of my big bugbears is uninformed policy, bad policy that isn't evidence based. You know. You can have policy evidence-based, you might be able to disagree here or there, but policy that isn't evidence-based, it really gets in my grill. And this is another scenario of that. So a coalition of 155 stakeholders rebuked the move, including the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service, the Law Council of Australia, Women's Legal Service Australia, and 15 retired judges. So effectively everyone who matters in this debate opposed it, but it seems to be a cost-cutting exercise of the government. They've had a long-time vendetta against the family court. And don't take my words for it. How about you take former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Elizabeth Evatt, who said, stakeholders have called for 3 years for the merger not to be passed out of concern it would have devastating impacts on families, resulting in a loss of structural, systematic specialisation and dismantle the appeals division. Now, if we're talking in real-world consequences here, I can't see how this doesn't have a detrimental effect on family violence. Now, the overwhelming majority of family violence is carried out by a man against a woman, and that's the cold hard facts, whether you like it or not. There seems to be some sort of perpetrator myth these days, perpetrated by a selected few in Parliament, i.e. Kevin Andrews and Pauline Hanson, that men are somehow discriminated against in the family court system. Now, there is absolutely no evidence, and that's an old wives' tale that needs to be dead and buried here today with this podcast. Because I've had my own personal experience in the family court system, and there is no bias whatsoever against the male or the female, right? And I'm sure us growing up in it, I don't want to talk too much here, Joe, but you can tell it's a very passionate issue to myself, is I grew up in a single parent household, and I wouldn't have changed a thing. I've been blessed with my life, having mum, my grandmother and my auntie around, as well as my cousins and everyone else around me, and having, you know, they afforded me some great opportunities in life. And to go through my personal experience when I was 12, my father waived custody rights to me when I was 2. When he was fighting for more rights to get more access to me, he just waived rights when I was 2. And then when I was 12, he came back and mum was served with papers from the Family Court of Australia in relation to seeking further custody rights of myself. Now, as a 12-year-old, obviously you get older, it's effectively what the child wants, and I imagine that's what it should be. That seems logical to me, and I was comfortable not going ahead and engaging with him, and that's what I felt comfortable, and I had good agency. Mum spent a lot of money on a good solicitor to prepare the affidavit and the other legal machinations around it. And I had a great caseworker that was assigned by the Family Court of Australia, and I got the outcome that I wanted, right? And that's where the specialisation of the Family Court of Australia comes in. But since 2013, there's been a budget cut of over, there's half the budget to $58 million a year. So effectively in 2013, the budget was $110 million or around that mark. And over the last 7 years, the funding cut has been to $58 million a year. What does that mean, Joe? It means cases get dragged out, larger pipelines, a 34% increase in case backlog, and a 63% increase in the Federal Circuit Court backlog. And now, we're wondering why people are waiting years to get their matters dealt with in the family court. It's because the funding's been ripped for it. These cost money. So the legal expertise in Australia, as most of us will know, is no cheap chicken. You know? That chicken is expensive.
That's, yeah.
And
free-range chicken.
We've got to the point now where they've held the court to ransom because of the budget cuts, and they've forced it into this merger in which you're going to lose specialisation of judges. You know, when judges retire, there's no guarantee to actually replace them. Certainly you lose a lot of caseworkers, I imagine. And I don't see how this actually goes ahead and solves any issues whatsoever in relation to the backlog. And don't get me wrong, there's obviously some path for improvement in the family court, reducing the backlog, but a lot of that will come from actually increasing the funding and increasing the judges available. Now, you can't tell me, Joe, there's not enough bloody lawyers in this country that you could assign a few more to the bloody Family Court of Australia. fair dinkum here. This is a disgrace. And I know, Joe, I've been talking about it for a while now, and perhaps for my assertions, you get some thought. Maybe for someone who's a bit more objective on this issue, you could give me some reflections.
Well, no, you've summed it up quite well. And, like, I'm still, as you said, like, someone who's been through these, like, systems before. Like, I haven't. So I'm still trying to get in as much as I can, take in as much information as I can to form my opinion. But having someone who's gone through the systems as yourself, like, that's the education people need to know. So it's like you sharing your experiences is huge, not just for me to learn more, to talk about it so other people can hear, but for the other people listening too. Somewhat like someone who's been in the situation, that's how, like, we just need to learn more about it. Like, I don't want to sit here and talk about this like I know it, because I haven't had the personal experience, and I don't want to, like, misguide my opinion. So I'm still trying to take in more. But I guess in this situation, what I can comment on is, from an education perspective, I guess you say here backlog will increase, so cases will take longer, right? Is that's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if cases are taking multiple years, violence can maintain, and the issues in the household can maintain, and that could stretch out for a few years, and that could be year 7, 8, 9 for a kid. Yeah. And by the time they're in year 10, they may have missed out on so much of their growth and so much of their education just because of having to deal with issues of violence at home.
Yeah.
So the backlog is extremely harmful. It's a butterfly effect in a kid's life throughout that will affect them for the rest of their life. You know what I mean? So backlog is, to me, that's the thing that jumps out at me the most. Obviously, the other statistics are huge too, but coming from an educational perspective, that's the statistic that jumps out huge to me.
Yeah, and I think you've drawn the real-world consequences out there very well, Mr. Boyden, and I've got to respect that. But just going back to, I think people wouldn't naturally tie these issues together, but I do like to tie things together thematically. It's always made a lot of sense to me since growing up, and what we've seen in both instances here is that there seems to be a lack of empathy missing from the debate, whether it be with Miss Higgins or with the Family Court of Australia and the real world implications of it on families and family violence, is that everything seems to be a political problem or a political cost.
Mm.
Doesn't actually look at the system and say, what are we actually in government for? What are we actually trying to provide services for?
Mm.
Are we trying to provide services so people feel safe at work? We're trying to provide services so that children can grow up in a safe and healthy environment.
Hmm.
Or are we looking at everything from a political cost? So that's where we're going to leave the debate here today. But if you're listening, for our small and loyal base that do listen, that's what I'd like to go away with today. And think about that. And think about when you have a discussion about it in future, think about who is actually involved in the system and what we're trying to achieve. Because the country's only as strong as its weakest link. And that's what the empathy... You know, Scott Morrison pays $190,000 for an empathy coach. Well, I don't need any money to tell you that empathy is one of the greatest gifts we have as a human. That's what separates us from a lot of other things in life.
You say he pays for an empathy coach.
He does.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's where we'll go ahead and leave it. And perhaps on a brighter note, we'll get to some sport. I know you guys love me talking about sport because, you know, we're better at watching it than playing it. But that's neither here nor there. And yeah, let's go.
My name is Novak Djokovic. Of course, I need no introduction because I'm the current king of the ATP and the world number one, and I'm going to teach you how to play the tennis. And a lot of people have asked Novak personally. They say, you know, you have so many accolades in the singles, and how do you become such a great singles player? But what a lot of people don't know is I am always sharing the court with someone else, and that person is my ego. So it...
Well, there you go, Novak Djokovic, the undisputed king of Rod Laver Arena. He's won a few championships down there. I believe that was his ninth. Australian Open. He's 9-0 in Australian Open Grand Finals. It's almost getting to the point where he is becoming the Rafa, what Rafa is to Paris and Roland Garros. Novak is here to the Australian Open. He seems unbeatable on the plexi cushion court. As a tennis aficionado myself, as much as it is to my dismay and his personal traits, he is one hell of a tennis player, and no doubt he's well and truly entrenched in the GOAT discussion. But Joe, I'd like to get your thoughts. Feels like a bit of an anticlimactic summer of tennis. Obviously, Melbourne experienced a mini lockdown halfway through the tennis, as Novak would say. And Ash Barty losing in the quarterfinal, and Kyrgios going off in the third round, and just brought a bit of a fizzle to the end of the tournament. What are your thoughts there, mate?
Yeah, we were just talking about this before. I couldn't get around it as much this year. I think because it came later, which I was explaining to you just before we went live on the airways.
Yeah, it was.
I think, like, coming from going to school, now going to uni, you're still in that summer period when the Australian Open's on. Whereas this year, because it came a bit later, you start at work, you're getting back into your normal life, and then the tennis kind of becomes harder to catch up with when it's played later than the summer than it usually is. So, yeah, I found it hard. I was invested in the Australians, so Kyrgios, Kokkinakis, and Demonor, and I don't know, when they got eliminated, like when Kyrgios got eliminated, my interest kind of died a little bit, whereas usually to the back end of summer, I'm usually right into it, watching up, like watch all the rest of the games, especially the finals. But this year, I just couldn't do it as much. I mean, disappointing. I look forward to the Australian Open every year, but this year, just, I don't know, it didn't seem right to me. It just seemed a little bit.
I mean, I feel like in the first week, it did gather a bit of momentum, especially when Kokkinakis got three, had a huge five-set epic against Tsitsipas. It would have been great if he would have won that. And then Kyrgios, you know, like out on John Cain Arena, the People's Court, you know, young audience, you know, like I think it was the last one, he was on the last one before lockdown against Dominic Thiem, and he went two sets up and he had everyone going from Arthur to Martha in the crowd, and then Thiem comes back and defeats him in three sets. He would have got through that, played Dimitrov, maybe had a chance of beating him. It would have been very enjoyable. Then you had the Ash, you know, the Barty party coming rolling along. I thought it was looking very good. A set up to the good in the quarterfinal. Hadn't looked trouble at all. All of a sudden, a medical timeout throws her. You're the world number one. You need to be better than that. As much as I do think the other girl was playing mind games with you, taking the timeout, you've got to be better than that. And she couldn't hit her first serve or her return game had gone to the proverbial bin. She got a Bennett and stay Hinnett. That's a little reference there to Andy Lee. How you going, mate? But yeah, I think it died off after that. And then, you know, the last remaining, you know, possible storyline was Ken Serena equal Margaret Court, and then she got bounced out by Osaka in the semi-final, and Osaka goes on to win it. As you said, the highlight of the weekend was when Osaka caught Brady. Jennifer asking after asking whether you prefer to be called Jenny or Jennifer, she said Jenny, and then she calls it Jennifer. I mean, that is some serious mind games there. Even that's just twisted in a slow knife. And then, you know, Novak just destroyed Medvedev in the final in the men's side. So I think that's a good place to leave the tennis and perhaps move on to something that we know a little bit more about. That is a bit of rugby league
footy.
Yeah, and of course it was return. It's always the start of the season when it's the Indigenous All-Stars versus the Maori All-Stars. Now, I was out on Saturday night, didn't catch this, but I caught some highlights on the early Sunday morning. And I got to say, I would have expected more points out of this one. A 10-all draw, the Maoris retain the trophy there, the All-Star trophy. But again, it's less so about the game, this one, and more so about the cultural celebration, the week leading up to it. They were up in Townsville, see big Indigenous population up there. You know, it's great to see they have a big week of festivities around it. You know, the Maori boys get around and do a haka, you know, and the Indigenous, and then it comes to the climax before the game where, you know, the Indigenous All-Stars do their, you know, their war dance, and then, of course, the Maori haka comes in. You know, it's just fantastic to watch the clash of cultures, you know. Yeah. They're both cultures that are steeped in thousands of years of history. And it's great to see. It was great to see Benji play with his younger brother, Jeremy. It was great to see Latrell lead the Indigenous war cry. And it was just fantastic all across the board. So hats off to the NRL for this. I think they are one of the best codes of celebrating this diversity. as compared to the AFL or other leagues around the country. So, yeah, Joe, perhaps you can give your thoughts on this and what the week signifies to you.
Yeah, I too didn't get to watch it. I was dealing with my own personal matters, but yeah, I was obviously keeping up with the score live on the app and quite shocked, 10-all. It's usually, you know, you watch that game expecting to see a lot of high flying.
Fergo.
Mate, Fergo down the sideline in the air, nose gaunt. So, I was surprised at the scoreline, but it's like, it's such a staple now. And it's actually something I like, it look forward to start the season. It's a perfect way to start the year every time. It's a celebration. I'm all for it. Like, yeah, as you said, the moment before the game, you get like goosebumps watching it. Like, it's incredible. Yeah, so it's definitely here to stay, and I think it's going to become such an important part of the NRL, just in terms of that celebratory style. Yeah. Whereas, you know, it's still a competitive event, but the celebration of it, it's such a great way to open the season. And I can't see the season starting anywhere else. I know they experimented with those different formats of All-Stars.
Yeah, but they've hit the money back,
They've nailed it, and I think this has to stay. They can even build off this for sure. I mean, the longer it happens, the more demand there's going to be for it.
Yeah, and of course, now we see the Women's Indigenous All-Stars against the Maori All-Stars again. Another step in the right direction for the women's game, which I think wouldn't be too far away from getting a couple of extra teams in the NRLW, which would be great to see. We'd love to see a Tigers team up there, you know. Any person repping the Tigers colours is close to Pulia Smith's heart.
It's just good to see the NRL try, like, kind of experimenting more and doing less, like, traditional sort of things just with your season, standard season. They try, like, I like to see them try new things out. I know there's the argument that it's just marketing ploys and blah blah blah, but it's good. Like, it's keeping fans on their toes, giving them something new. It's not repetitive. It's a great way to spot different players on teams that are still trying to earn their stripes. Great way of recognition for people who wouldn't have it otherwise. So yeah, I'm all for it. I love this event.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great place to leave that. And perhaps now we can go into something that I'm sure, no doubt, from Joel Schiffler down in Abbotsford Cove all the way down to MJ Skinner in Bradenton, Canberra. I've been looking forward to that is the review of the Summer of Cricket. Now, we're going to keep this one short and sharp because it's something that's still not sitting well in the pool of your household, that Australia lost a home series against India, effectively full strength, while India were battling, you know, plowing up against a third grade team and managed to get the bickies over in the Gabba, someplace we haven't lost in 32 years. But the question I pose here in the podcast brief, and Joe, perhaps I'd like to get your insights in this because I know you're quite passionate about it, is, are we living in the Indian century?
This pissed me off so much when you sent it to me. I wanted to throw my phone out the window. Oh, the Indian century.
Oh, there it goes.
That's 100 years, mate. I know we... What was it? Did you say 32 years at the Gabba?
Yeah.
But you're talking about a century?
Well, some people have been talking about the next 3 centuries and won't be able to
beat it. A century. Yeah. Mate, we pull off that win against England in the Ashes and everyone's loving it. Now, one home loss. I mean, it wasn't just one. We lost a few years ago to India at home, but another home loss to India and we're talking about the century. Are we living in the Indian
Century? What I'm going to hear is a bigger geopolitical point that the great cricketer brought up. You know, 19th century Pax Britannica. You know, the UK dominating, you know, the world of global trade. 20th century, American dominance. 21st century, Indian IT dominating the world. You know, Indian cricket is dominating the world.
Like that.
The geopolitical influence. You know, what's to say as a few more Indians get a bit more money, a bit more middle class, or as their economy continues to grow, that more money is pumped into cricket. That's
the beauty of sport. It's unpredictable. You can't do these things, mate. You can't predict sport.
Yeah, well, I'll pass it on to the TGC boys, and I'll see what they can get back to you with.
Mate, that's something that I realise a lot as an Australian sports fan. We're so pessimistic and we're so quick to jump off the ship. But I have a mate who's from India and he's a cricket fanatic. And any series I lived with him and any series where India were getting dusted, his passion is incredible. You know, he's never talking the team down, he's never questioning their future success. He's, you know what I mean, he's not jumping off ship, But Australian sports fans are so quick to jump off ship. And I mean, crap, I'm one of them in a lot of ways. But like, there's no way this is an Indian century, mate. There's not a chance.
Fair enough.
It's not a chance.
I told to your perspective. I just think, given where we are, I think what will dominate in this next 10, 20 years will be these Australian India series as well as perhaps the England India series.
It's also an arrogant statement as well to say, is this the Indian century just because they came and beat us at home? Asking if it's the Indian century is implying that we are the absolute cream of the crop, top notch, best thing in the world. So just because India beats us,
we were the number one test team.
Yeah, I mean rankings, the series rankings in cricket, and that you can never believe them too much because they're like the regularity in which they play doesn't set a proper ranking system in my opinion. Test cricket, you go to different places in the world. It's a slower game, so world rankings I don't think are super accurate. I think you have your top five or whatever, but ranking those top five one by one, I mean, it's different. Like, I guess, with a team like Bangladesh and Australia, it's easy to put one above the other. But when you get to those top-tier teams, what, number one and number two, like, to me, that means nothing. Yeah. If you're in the top five test teams in the world, to me, you're all sitting on a similar level.
For me, it was just more the way that the series played out. You started in Adelaide and perhaps, that... awesome bowling display, bowling them out for 36 and then managed to get the win. Papered over a few cracks that sort of started to reveal, later in the series, and injury after injury. That Brisbane to Indian team, you would have laughed your way out of the city if you found out that was going to be the team at the start of the series. I mean, what did they have, like two of their 11 playing that final game? Australia was effectively full strength. I know we didn't have Bukowski. But again, it goes to a point of a lack of batting depth outside a couple of worldies in Warner and Warner and Smith. Obviously, our bowling attack was good, but even the bowling plans, it lacked imagination. Back of a length, and into the short balls. There just seems to be none of the things that actually worked for Australia. Whereas India, Washington Sundar, I bet no one had even heard of him before. He came on the tour. Here he is. He was under 19s. Batting number four is batting number eight here for India. Gets a valuable 60, takes 6 wickets in the match. Who was the other guy who came in? Forgot his name, but he hit a 70 and took 7 wickets. It's just the amount of depth. When you got 1 billion people, and 1 billion people who are obsessed with the cricketing nation, and you look at some of the talent coming through the IPL, it's just you just wonder as where. My cousin's always talking about this, when the next series will be in 35 years. So, again, it's a very macro question that I know my compatriot here, Joe Boyden, doesn't particularly like the premise of. But
It's not that I don't like it. It's just that we haven't just dug and struck gold just in the last week with this idea. Like, India have had 1 billion people for a long time. They've been good at cricket for a long time. They've put a lot of emphasis on cricket for a long time. So I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying this conversation, it's just ironic that it happens after one loss. I chalk that loss up to, the issues with the Australian cricket team and their game plan, whatever. But also, I chalk it up to India dug deep and they pulled off a miraculous underdog performance. Sport history has been filled with underdog performances.
Indeed it has. But
so, to me, I'm not going to toss away our chances in the future.
Neither am I. Let it be known that I still hold great hopes for the Indian tour of 2022. But I think a lot of things are going to have to improve in our ability to play spin on subcontinental decks that turn left and right, left foot, right foot, levitating. But that's neither here nor there. I think that's a good place to wrap that discussion up there. Again, send us in your thoughts. It is a very big question, posed. But yes, it's a worthy question, and one of the great cricketer podcasts that I've been getting around a lot recently did pose. And if you haven't listened to their wrap up of the series, it is a worthwhile listen because they do it just after about 6:30 on the day they lost in Brisbane, and the emotions are flowing. The emotions are flowing in there. And it was very funny there. The intertextual referencing was great. But That's where we're going to wrap up our sport debate there. We'll just be back shortly with a few fan questions. And when I say a few, we've had to go through hundreds and hundreds of our long-time listeners to actually disseminate the ones we're going to answer. So there'll be some good ones coming up. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back to the final part of the podcast. Here we are with some fan questions. Again, we've decided to go with three ones that we thought were worthy of being aired today. First couple here for Mr. Joe Borden. First one from Andy Lee from Bankstown. Joe, how long do you think you would last at Ashfield Boys High?
That's a good question, Andy. Yeah, look, I've had a couple of people tell me this, so I think it's the way it has to be. I don't think I'd last a minute at Ashfield
Boys. Oh, really? Right. I think it's a bit of overhype there, Ashfield Boys. any school that our producer Andy Lee or Marty Lye, yeah, a couple of soft white boys there, mate. Here one from Joel Schiffler, again for you, Joe. A topic very close to both of your hearts. Joel Schiffler from Abbotsford, I should say. Chances of Paris Premiership hopes this year.
Bloody brilliant, mate.
Yeah.
Nah, we're looking good.
Yeah.
Nah, in reality, I have faith. I am nervous after last year's exit that we both witnessed live. I have good hope. It's good team. They've stuck together. We didn't lose any key pieces, which is huge, I think. So I think the team will gel a bit more, and hopefully they can play down the stretch a bit harder. I know I predict, like last year, they'll probably start hot again. I think their biggest challenge is getting past that round 10 and putting good performances on the board and scoring points. Their points dried up at the end of last year. And luckily, they did work early in the season to get them into the finals. But if we can score points in the back end of the season, I think we can come into the finals feeling confident. And I think they're a very dangerous team when they're confident in scoring points. So I reckon we have good chances.
Yep. Being a Tigers or being a Parramatta fan, I imagine too, you have to have optimism, and it was clear that optimism and hope were shining through an objective answer there. But that's neither here nor there. Joe, you got a question here?
I do. This is from Nick Doherty. He said, "Pools, I've spotted you and heard of people spotting you around Sydney Rowing Club lately. Is there any reason for why that may be?"
Oh, there is, and that is because I'm a passionate local representative of my local clubs, you know, your local club, and it's what I'm all about. Your local club is a lifeblood of the local community. You know, obviously employs a lot of people, puts a lot of money back into the club, supports a lot of local sporting organisations, such so as the Sydney Rowing Club, one of the most oldest and prestigious sporting organisations in Sydney. So any other conjecture as to any other reason I might be down there citing some grade one talent, that would be neither here nor there. So yeah, stick to your facts, mate, and perhaps don't listen to everything that you hear around the traps, and get around your local clubs. I'm a member of three great local clubs: Five Dock RSL, Sydney Rowing Club, and Burwood Briar Sports. And I'm a passionate local representative of them, and look forward to seeing what the future holds for these wonderful local clubs and the spirit they are in the community.
That's a well-composed answer, my friend.
Thanks very much.
Almost like you were prepared. But no, thanks for having me back, Pools.
Yeah, well,
it's great to be back.
It is great to be back, and I said you can't keep a good man down for too long. So that's the words of wisdom I leave you with here today.
Year of the Ox, baby.
Year of the Ox, mate. You cannot beat the Year of the Ox. Strong-hearted, strong-willed, always looking to improve day in, day out. Every day is a learning day. And that's what we want to learn at the end of the day. So there we go. We'll leave it there. And thanks so much for joining us. And again, don't forget to send in your questions. But I am me, and he is he. I am Joe. He is Tom. What the hell did I just say? That's the end of the podcast. Thanks very much.